This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing, my chance to talk with artists, policymakers, and performers, to hear their stories, what inspires their creations, what decisions changed their careers, what relationships influenced their work. My guest today, Penn Jillette, is the speaking half of the duo Penn and Teller. Their act mixes magic and comedy with a subversive element that turns the traditional magic act on its head. In addition to having one of the longest-running shows in Las Vegas, Penn Jillette is also a musician, juggler, and inventor. The 6'6", outspoken atheist and libertarian also finds time to write books, host TV shows, and appear as a contestant on Dancing with the Stars and The Celebrity Apprentice. Recently, Penn Jillette performed a feat harder than any magic trick. He made 100 pounds disappear.
I had wicked high blood pressure, and I was telling myself, because it's easy to tell yourself this, that it's genetic, or there's nothing you can do about it, and then there is.
Sure.
I just started eating in order to fix my blood pressure, which ends up as a side effect, losing a lot of weight.
So were you leaner and kind of readier when you were young and you got heavier as you got older?
Yeah, sure. I was an American is another way to say that.
Right.
Yeah.
And, Americans, so what were you eating that was doing you? What was the problem?
Well, now I'm eating
What are you not eating now?
Eating no animal products, no refined grains, extremely low salt, sugar, and oil. So I'm not able to do things in moderation.
Yeah.
One of the reasons I've never had a drink or any drug in my life is I'm very aware that moderation is not my strong suit.
I can't imagine you and I, yeah. You and I trapped in this room with a bowl of cocaine and the two trail mix bars and the cacao. Which we wouldn't eat the food if we had the cocaine.
Yeah, would be like. But so I've never, had so much as a puff of marijuana.
No.
That's true.
Really?
Never a sip of beer because
why?
Well, my personality is such. Not only do I not do moderation, I also don't respect it. If you tell me about an author that I need to read, I will go home and read everything. You know, when I start to listen to a different kind of music, if all of a sudden I discover Alban Berg, I'm listening to all 12-tone German opera for months. And I love living like that. I mean, a lot of people seem to strive for moderation. I don't.
So if you and your wife are going to have a family, you're going to have like 12 children?
Yeah, we have a 13th child. We have our 13th child. Fortunately, you're able to stop that with a vasectomy.
Right. Sure.
And you don't have to do any moderation whatsoever.
Science
can step in on these things.
Intervene. So what's something that you craved or liked or that you stopped eating?
It's really interesting, but...
Do you mind me asking about this?
No, not at all.
I go up and down in my diet
I find that it's exactly like situation comedies. When you're watching situation comedies every night when you're younger, they kind of make sense and you want to watch them the next night. But if you stop for 2 months and you go back and watch a situation
what
comedy,
is this shit?
It's nonsense. why would anybody watch this? Right. Don't they have real friends?
Yeah.
Why are they watching this?
Where do they get all that money for that apartment?
And the same thing with food. I really, for the first, couple of months, wanted hamburgers and, fried chicken and all that stuff all the time. And then after a couple of months, the food I was eating tasted great.
Yeah.
It's exactly like, you listen to music, you listen to that 4-on-the-floor, 3-chord rock and roll, and you love it, and it's great. And then all of a sudden, someone says, oh, and there's jazz. And you go, oh, there's whole different sounds and different stuff. It's that salt, sugar, fat is just that boom, 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 boom. But you take that away and there's a zillion other flavors. Everything changes, including, and I'm a little bit embarrassed about this because I tend to, as much as I'm a strong atheist, I still catch myself occasionally in a mind-body separation, thinking that there's some sort of intellectual side different than the physical side. I was really surprised how my mood changed.
Are you ready to become a Catholic?
Very close. Very close.
Inches away. Let's go to the Vatican together. He's dying to meet you. He loves your stuff. He thinks you're great. I talk to him all the time.
There's a great story.
I told him I'm doing the show with you.
There's a great story about Roy, of Siegfried and Roy, meeting the Pope.
I didn't know that.
And Siegfried and Roy met the Pope, the great magicians. They meet the Pope. And Roy gives him a ring. And the Pope takes the ring and hands it to the assistant as this is a gift. Right. And then Roy goes, no, that is for you to bless and give back to me.
Oh, my God.
And that's...
Yeah.
Which is all you need to know about Roy and the Pope.
Exactly.
Now, when you
You just touched on many subjects, atheism, Siegfried and Roy, and magic, the Pope. Religion.
Covered everything.
You've covered everything. We're done. We can have some cacao now. But let's talk about that. Meaning, did you know you were an atheist from the earliest consciousness you had?
Or no.
That evolved?
I was. You know, people do this thing that that I always feel very. I feel it's very important to point out. They always say, you know, religious people must have treated you badly. I'm a religious person. I'll treat you well. The point is, religious people treated me wonderfully. I have always been treated very well by religious people. I was raised, I have a perfect family life. My mom and dad and my sister and I were very, very close. I was raised a Congregationalist.
Massachusetts.
Yeah, Massachusetts, Western Mass. And I went to church.
How far from Springfield was your town?
An hour.
Yeah.
You know, north. When I got to be junior high age, my parents said I could go to youth group instead of Sunday morning services I wanted to, and I went to youth group, and I believe I was the only one who took it seriously, and the minister spoke with us about religion, and I read the Bible, and then came in with some questions, and I had a wonderful, wonderful minister who was very open and would talk with me for hours. I did this exactly the way the church would want you to do it. There was no horrible rebellion.
Open.
There was no fuck you. There was no screaming. There was no
raping,
being molested.
Yeah.
I have not one horror story. Yeah. I have just kind, wonderful, sweet people and an intellectual discussion. And I went, you know, I don't like the idea of putting God before my family. My family's more important to me. And I don't like the idea of there being a love greater than the love I have for my family and friends. And I do believe that humans are good on their own without this. And I don't think anything happens after we die. And my minister,
You sound like a moderate Republican.
there's no way to tell this story without making him look like a goofball, but he's not a goofball. This is a sensible thing. He called up my mom and dad and said, you know, Penn is doing wonderful in youth group, but we're having discussions, and I believe he's doing a better job at converting the other children to atheism than I am with Christianity.
Yeah.
So
why
don't you just not have him come to youth group anymore?
Yeah.
And I talked to my parents, and my dad, till the day he died, prayed for me and would say—
What faith was he?
Like
Congregationalist.
Said, yeah, Congregationalist.
Right.
And he would say to me all the time, like, well, Penn, you are such a good Christian. And I'd say, except for that not accepting Christ thing, Dad. except for that.
But if you separate out the dogma of a particular religion, because I'm a Catholic. Mm-hmm. I was raised a Catholic. And over the arc of my life. Over the arc of my life, I've lapsed and gone back and lapsed and gone back. But a priest who I grew up with, who was a priest in the church I went to when I was a boy, he said it best. He said, listen, all the great religions have something to offer to me, Hinduism and Judaism and Buddhism and so forth, and Muslim. He said, the Catholics just seem to have the nicest places to hang out,
the nicest
real estate. But you separate all the dogma of any particular religion, and to me, atheism is you just don't believe there's a God.
Right. And I also—
regardless of your individual relationship with
that God. Right. There is no moral— a code that goes along with that. There's a lot of stuff we've noticed about atheists, you know, but there isn't an actual church of atheism. And I wanted to say with a great deal of pride that my mom, when she was 85
converted
years—
converted to atheism.
85 years old.
My God.
And what did it was—
Penn did win, didn't he?
But this is the great—
And your father was like, God damn you, Penn!
my dad used to say, and this is, you know, just a tribute to how—my dad was the most wonderful man I've ever met. My dad would say to me, I'm going to have to work so hard after I die to get you and your mother into heaven.
Yes.
But I'm going to do it. I just have to work very, very hard. You can make it so much easier for me.
Yes.
You have to know that my mom and my dad never said hell or damn or any obscenity in the house. Hardcore. No alcohol, no hell or damn. When I started doing card tricks, my father was like, you won't be gambling, though. You can do card tricks, but I don't like having a deck of cards in the house. I would say, Dad, I'm just doing manipulations and tricks. Well, that's fine.
Now, when people obviously, when they think of you as part of a tandem, and your partner, it's always mystifying to me, the mute performer. What's that like for him to play that role all these years?
Well,
it's 30 years.
40.
It's, good God.
And it is a very...
Does he never shut up when he's home? Does he, like,
well,
does
that's the joke.
Yeah.
Everybody in the crew will tell you, Penn speaks on stage, doesn't speak off stage. Teller doesn't speak on stage, never shuts up.
Right.
If you were to come to one of
you
our
flip.
Rehearsals, it's me sitting over in the corner reading the paper. And Teller talking to everybody, handling everything. Teller's essentially...
Olivier Lucille Ball
the
told
director.
Me.
Yes, yeah.
He's recanting.
But, you know, Teller directs Shakespeare. You know, he's directing The Tempest in Chicago. A wonderful production with real magic
he
in it.
He loves acting in theater.
But more directing and more writing. And he's very articulate. He was a high school Latin and Greek teacher. And he is a classic scholar.
Where does he live? Where is his home?
Vegas.
So you guys both live in the
same... Yeah, about... 5 miles apart.
Yeah. And you have a theater that's your own theater.
Yeah.
It's like that whole Celine Dion thing.
It's the Penn and Teller Theater. Yeah. It's really
and
nice.
And you're obligated, the contract is how many months of the year?
Oh, it's till we die. I mean, we do.
See, how many shows
a
year?
We do 46 weeks a year. 40.
No.
Yeah. When you, if we ever cross your mind, if you ever, well, we don't have time off.
Oh my God.
And we sometimes do runouts on the day
you
supposedly.
46 weeks in Vegas?
We do about 250 shows a year, a little more. It's a pretty easy schedule, but I make it as hard as possible because I play upright bass jazz bebop for an hour before the show,
right.
And then we meet everybody after the show. So we turn a cushy 90-minute gig into 3.5
hours. You're like Steve Martin.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have your own band and everything.
Yeah, yeah, I do. When Steve's in town, I love to talk music with him.
When you were a child, I mean, I grew up, and anything magic or anything of the paranormal, if you will, Uri Geller, Kreskin, all those things. I mean, I grew up glued to that. I love that. Were you glued to that kind of stuff? Or when did it come into your life?
I was horrified by Kreskin. I believed when he went on a television show and he did an experiment, as he called it. And I believed this was an area of science. I was fascinated by science, an area of science that I wanted to study. And my parents, who I said weren't wealthy, bought me was little ESP game, this piece of shit, with a little pendulum and the ESP cards. And then I would do that with my parents over and over. And then because I was becoming a juggler and practicing all the time in the library, if you cast your mind back to the Dewey Decimal System,
yes.
You know that the 900s are religion. Magic, juggling, they're all there together, which is great. My whole life is in the 900s of the Dewey Decimal System. I happened to see a Dunninger book, The Mentalist, from the 40s.
I don't know him.
Yeah, he was the most popular mentalist, mind reader. And I opened the book on magic, and in there was the description of how to do the trick I'd seen Kreskin do as an experiment. And that moment in the library was a complete breakdown. I mean, I could not believe that a scientist, which is the way I perceived it, had lied to me. And I went home, I was humiliated in front of my parents.
So here's the birth of the bullshit show, too, by the way.
Absolutely. It's everything, my whole life.
Yeah.
And I also pretty much at that point went from straight A's to failing.
No.
Because I said to my physics teachers.
What's the meaning of it all?
Scientists lie. Why am I listening to you? Scientists lie.
What
scientists
is real?
And I hated magic. Hated magic because why would you be fooling people? It's hard enough to figure out about the world.
Life is hard enough.
Yeah, why are you doing that? And my parents, you know, would try to console me. It's just a stupid little game, Ben. Calm down. It's okay. No, I'm a juggler. I'm not a magician. I'm not da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
All of this. And it wasn't until I met Teller, who I met when I was in high school. Teller's 7 years older than me. And Amazing Randy. And they explained to me the very simple thing that if you put a proscenium around something, it's all of a sudden moral. If Robert De Niro runs around New York saying he's Travis Bickle and he's a cab driver, he is insane.
They put him away.
If he does it in a movie,
we give him an Oscar.
He's a genius. Yes. And the same thing with magic. If you come to our show, all the stuff we do would be immoral if you take that proscenium
away. So you did a lot on the street. You were on the streets.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But always as a juggler there.
Right.
It wasn't. So we try to follow this very strict moral code in the Penn and Teller show, which is what I call the sawing a woman in half code. Sawing a woman into half.
Describe that.
Which is, we saw a woman into halves on stage. You see that. No one leaves the theater thinking they've witnessed a murder.
Right.
Nobody. That is my rule for all magic. If I'm going to do a mind reading trick, you cannot leave the theater thinking that I can read minds. It must be exactly the same as not witnessing a murder. There's a lot of intellectual and moral gymnastics that need to be done in order to follow that code. And Teller and I, a big part of our writing tricks is trying to be intellectually honest.
So what is required of the street performer that you had? Some people are on the street and they score.
With my parents' permission, you know, left home when I was 18 and was essentially homeless, hitchhiking around the country, hippie. And I supported myself juggling on streets and juggling in bars. And you need to gather a crowd, and you need to collect the money.
So a bit of a barker quality to it.
Yeah, or as they called it, the carny talker. I was a really, really good street performer. As a matter of fact, Teller, I'm not sure how to take this, but Teller always says, you know, the best thing you've ever done in your career was your 12-minute street act. There was really nothing better than that.
Where was the money good? What was the place that was like?
I had a rule that I would only work places that it was illegal because I thought that was sexy.
Right.
And I worked Head House Square in Philadelphia and knew all the police officers. And the police officers would come to my show and say, the second someone can convince me that you're begging, I'll arrest you. Until then, you're doing a show.
Right.
And I would do, I was making so much money. I was 19 years old and I was making so much money street performing. I went to an accountant. And I said,
to file taxes.
I said, I want to file my taxes on the money I made. And he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm a street juggler. And he said, how much do you make? And I told him. And I said, I have, you know, I keep records of every hat I pass and how much I make. And I have it all laid out here. And I have when I brought it to the bank and when I did everything. And he said, and you're 19? I said, yeah. And he said, if you go to the IRS and tell them you made this much money juggling, they will arrest you as a drug dealer. They will assume you're a drug
lying.
Dealer.
You're lying.
And then he said, and oh, by the way, I think you're a drug dealer.
Yeah. Right.
By the way, I don't believe
you seem like a drug dealer.
And I said, well, no, I'm really making this. He goes, take the money, don't put it in the bank, keep it in cash, walk away.
And when does that change? Meaning then you're doing that.
Then I put all that money, well, first of all, totally ruined my voice because I'd work for 500 people outside, no training, just scream and put
in all weather.
Put chloroseptic in a Coke can and just go.
What was your costume? Did you have a costume?
Oh, yeah. My rule on street performing was you have to look so that people are embarrassed to give you less than a 20.
So what's the key to that?
I wore a $3,000 watch. When I street performed, I wore a really expensive suit, really expensive pants, was perfectly groomed, much more.
You look more like Michael Douglas than the Artful Dodger.
Absolutely, yeah, right. Absolutely. My idea was I want to make as much money as Johnny Carson, so I'll be out there looking like Johnny Carson.
Right.
So the idea was I would gather a crowd and you'd come up and go, man, he's really funny. He's really a good juggler. You'd be with your date and go, I can't give him 50 cents.
Yeah.
Well, I'll get a 20.
Two rumpled up singles.
Yeah, you can't do that. And then Teller would alternate with me in the same spot, which we kind of owned. And the local hoodlum children loved us because what I would do is I'd, you know, have them take care of my money and buy props for me and take care of that kind of stuff, trusted them. So anybody else that came in to take that spot, the police arrested them and the local kids harassed them. So we had that spot to ourselves.
Yeah.
And I would go to all the store owners that are around there. I would go up after every show and say, you're getting enough traffic in and out. I'm not blocking. Everything's okay.
Yeah.
The police officers liked us.
You joined the Chamber of Commerce.
Yes,
there.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And we did that very well. Then I really got interested in doing, Teller and I wanted to do a full evening show. We thought that the ideas that we had were more than just the 12 minutes. So we took all the money that we had made street performing and put it into buying lights and sound and producing
And went where
shows.
First? You're off the street and you go where?
Our very first shows were at the Walnut Street Theater. They had a space that would seat like 75 people. And they had put that aside with a grant for experimental theater. And the experimental theater company could not get it together in 3 months to put an experimental show on. Now, you know, they couldn't in 3 months get it together. So they came to Teller, who they'd gone to college with, and said, you're doing your little show. Can you just put it in and we'll let you have the theater for free? Now, they were getting grants. We could have the theater for free. So we put the show up. And we charged whatever it was, $10, and we got wonderful reviews and put the place up. And then the head of the Walnut Street Theater called us in and said, "So the theater company up there, they gave you the space, and how much money did they give you to put this on?" We said, "Oh, nothing. They just gave us a space, which is a big help, man, huge help. Not to pay rent, we could really make money on this. We're supporting ourselves. This is terrific. We're getting going." He goes, "Yeah, yeah," and they were paid money to put a show on in there, and they just gave it to you free. So you guys are welcome to use the theater whenever you want, and they're losing all their grants. So we became the people that killed them. Experimental theater in that particular. And they were like, "What did you do to us?" We said, we didn't know we were supposed to lie. We could have said we can't make money in there, but as it turned out, we could make money. You know, in a 100-seat theater, we could fill it up and make money doing 8 shows a week.
So you perform inside and you start to do the show. And what kind of a show was it back then?
Well, it was a 3-person show then. We had a third partner who did classical music, and it was called the Asparagus Valley Cultural Society. Uh-huh. And we did a thing that was so nuts. Keller was in charge of putting the ads together and putting them in the paper, and I was in charge of getting critics to the show. So I just put on my leather jacket and went, you know, to the list of people that were critics and walked up to their desks and said, "Hi, I'm Penn. We're doing a show next Friday. We can give you free tickets. Would you come and review our show?" to the head critic of the Philadelphia Inquirer, who went, "What are you doing here?" "No, you go through your press agent and do this." And he said, "Why should I come see your show?" And I went, "Because I can do this." And I picked up his little spindle that he put papers on and rammed it in my head and jammed it in my nose, doing a thing called blockhead, an old carny trick. And, you know, and then took out a cigarette lighter and did a little bit of fire eating stuff and said, "Come see our show." And he was not supposed to review little shows. He was the big critic, but he came to see our show. And then he wrote a rave review, which pissed off everybody because other big shows were opening. And then Teller said, "You have to call him up and thank him." So I said, "Okay." So I called him up and said, "Thank you for your review. It's going to sell a lot of tickets. We're doing really well." And he said, "Did you like the review?" And I said, "Well, it's going to sell a lot of tickets. It's going to do really well." And he goes, "Wait a minute. Did you like the review?" I said, "Well, it's selling a lot of tickets, and I appreciate it. Thank you very much, sir." And he said, "What are you saying?" I said, "I'm saying it's awful. You don't understand a thing we were doing. It's all, you say kind stuff about us, but I did this show so someone would understand it. You missed the point of everything I was saying. It broke my heart." And there was a long pause, and he said, "Can I do an interview with you for like a few hours, and then I will write another review? I'll see the show again." And I said, "Sure." I told Teller, Teller said, "Did you thank him?" I said, "Yeah, I told him his review sucked." Teller said, "Oh, what are you doing?" And he, 2 weeks later, wrote another bigger review that said,
"More to your liking, I assume.
This is a retraction of my previous review.
Oh, good God.
I said they were wonderful, and they are, but everything else I said was wrong."
Wow.
And then he went in and wrote a whole other review. So now,
how do I get people to
do that
for me?
We've got a 100-seat theater that have had 2 front page of the entertainment section reviews within 2 weeks. So all of a sudden,
you're selling tickets.
We're sold out, you know, 100 seats.
Yeah.
You know, selling 100 seats is not that hard, but it was huge to us.
Yeah.
And then a producer saw us there, and we went out and played in San Francisco for 3 years at a theater there that was 198 seats or something.
I remember reading an article once about, because I'm thinking about Vegas and what I know about Vegas acts. And I've been to Vegas a few times, but not a lot. I'm not a gambler. I go see shows.
So how'd you miss that vice?
I never dug gambling.
With your background, it seems like, you know, the...
Well, I always would have thought, I would go, and people would gamble, and I think, and I lost, and I thought, I can't afford this.
Oh,
I don't have money to throw away. And I'd see guys who do that. I mean, I don't want to name names, but I got some pretty high-end friends of mine who really blow a lot of dough on that. And I go, God, how do you do that? And it's so irresponsible.
There are many other ways to waste money.
Well, yeah. I
mean, exactly.
I mean, like boats. I like boats. That's almost worse than gambling in some way because you can drown. But I was reading this article once, this wonderful old article about Wayne Newton, and they said how, the big punchline was that the guy goes and he takes with a stopwatch the measure of the show, and Newton would come out for the encore and say, hey, you know, we never do this. I never do this, but I just love this crowd. I never play this song, uh-huh. but you know, I'm just going to throw all my my preferences to the wind here. And he comes, and we never stay for another song. I'm going to do one more song, yeah. and he just teases the audience. And the guy, and every show, the show ended exactly the same time.
Exactly.
The show was exactly like 1 hour and 14 minutes.
Oh, Wayne Newton. Did you ever see Wayne Newton's show there?
No.
Oh,
no.
It was just great.
No, I'm sure it was phenomenal.
It probably still is. I haven't seen him in a few years.
But the idea of the show being for the man who you and your partner do 250 shows a year, regardless of the fact that it's in your own space, and mm-hmm. you know, it's obviously it's a very lucrative thing, is like, do you go out there and there's a menu, like a playlist?
Oh, no. We do the same show.
You do the same show.
Now, we're always writing new stuff. So when I say the same show, it's the same show as the night before, not the same show as the year before.
Right.
And I love that. You know, there's this thing that happens in the variety arts. You know, I'm just old enough. I'm 60.
You're an AGVA.
Yes, I am. I'm AGVA. I am an AGVA.
I know.
I'm a proud AGVA man. I'm 60. So when I was learning to juggle at 15, 16, 17, I could just meet the guys who worked vaudeville their whole life, right? I could just meet the guys who wrote a show when they were 17 years old and were doing it when they were 80 and hadn't changed it.
Yeah. Perform with Jolson.
Yeah. But there were guys, jugglers, you know, because juggling, it's not like music. You can't do a whole different routine with juggling. You learn that trick. It takes you 6 years to learn the trick. That's the trick you're going to be doing for a while, you know. You know how to throw a cigarette behind your back, catch it in your mouth, and throw a match, catch it, and then light them. That's what you're going to do. That's your closer for the rest of your life. And there's something you're able to do after doing something 10,000 times, not 1,000, 10,000 times, where you're able to communicate with the audience in ways that you don't even know what's giving them the information. When you first do a gag, you know, one of the things you see on Saturday Night Live, you know, I always want to say, boy, I'd like to see this sketch after they did it 10,000 times. As Bob Dylan said, I want to play guitar without tricks. You know, all the tricks would be gone, and it would just be the material that you're just selling, and I just love that. So Teller and I try to be very conscientious, and there's some stuff that's only a few months old, but there's other stuff that we've been doing 40 years. There's one trick that actually predates Penn and Teller that Teller did alone.
Dunninger?
That he's doing, it's a Houdini trick that Teller does, and goddamn it, we're in rehearsals, so we decided to really spruce up the show and worked with John Rando, who's a great, great director.
Wonderful.
Great director. We decided, we haven't worked with a director ever, and so we're going through stuff we've done 10,000 times, and we're going through with the director and going through moment by moment. Now, getting us in the afternoon to do a trick we've done 10,000 times, like, what the fuck are you doing? We know how to do this. But we get in there, and we wanted to do it, wanted to dig in, and I'm watching Teller from the wings, you know, just the other night, watching him do a trick that is the first trick I ever saw him do. So I saw him do this trick when I was first meeting him, before there was a Penn and Teller. Watching him do the first trick I ever saw. And I'm watching him going, you know, in Teller's whatever he is, 67 years old now. I saw him first do it when he was, you know, 25. And I'm watching the trick and I go, God damn, he's better. You know, and we have this thing in our culture that if the Rolling Stones are doing Satisfaction, they should have outgrown that. They should have done this. We've done this temporary thing in our culture that forgets the fact that, God damn, people can get good at shit. Yeah. People can get really good at stuff.
One thing Penn and Teller got very good at was shocking David Letterman during their multiple appearances on his show. Here's an unsuspecting Dave suggesting that their act was missing something.
You know, originality.
Originality. But, you know, I guess the thing that I missed most out of the whole deal was it just didn't seem to be an element of a real surprise. There just didn't seem to be any surprise to the whole
thing. Then Teller lifted a hat off Dave's desk, casually revealing a pile of live cockroaches.
Oh!
This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. You can hear all of my other interviews with entertainers, politicians, and entrepreneurs in our archives at heresthething.org. Like my conversation with Gillette's friend David Blaine, another world-famous magician known for extreme feats of physical endurance.
You're standing on a beam you were up there
36 hours.
Yeah, 36 hours. How was that on your body?
Well, you know,
When I was a little kid in school and I'd get in trouble and the teacher would say, go stand in the corner. I was like, come on, this is easy. Like, you stand for 45 minutes is supposed to be hard. Yeah. So, yeah, and then you can apply that. So it's like, how long can you stand in one place? So that's really what it's about.
Take a listen at heresthething.org. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. In addition to his show in Vegas, my guest Penn Jillette regularly appears in television and film. He's also done some stage acting. He had a part in The Exonerated, a play that brings to life the stories of a half dozen former death row inmates. Penn doesn't strike you as a man who was afraid of much, but he says for that project, the fear was real.
They put me into that with Bob Balaban. Directing it.
Sure.
And I was terrified, you know.
Why?
Because I had never done that straight kind acting. Of legitimate acting. Right. And I was on stage like Mia Farrow and, you know, and yeah. And Peter Coyote and people yeah. that, you know, can act.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know. And I just loved it. I love taking someone else's words.
You should do more of that.
I love thinking about that. And the few times I've done little movie things and stuff, I've just really,
you should
really
do more.
It.
I really mean that. You should do more. I mean, I know that means stopping doing this other
thing,
which
is your
big... Why
don't you and I do Orphans?
What's that Orphan? Well, I can think of a lot of things you should do. Seriously, I can think of a lot of parts.
But I really, really like it.
You should play Hickey in Iceman.
I did a wonderful, but there was a wonderful moment when they were doing that the movie about blacklisting with De Niro. I forgot the name of it, but he was having a friend. But I was going to play the part. I was auditioning for the part of Bunny, and I got to read with De Niro. I got that far that I get to read with De Niro.
That's enough in a
so
way, isn't
I'm
it?
Sitting there in front of the camera, and we're going through our script, and he's just kind of mumbling through it. He's not doing anything. You know, he's just, and I'm going, oh, that's no big deal. I'm doing with De Niro, and I'm reading my part, and I'm going, wow, I'm doing a really good job here. I mean, even compared to De Niro, I'm doing really good.
Yeah.
And then there comes the moment where he has to grab his friend who sold him out have blacklisted him, you know, who's me, who's a college friend, and like hug me and grab me and do this whole... And all of a sudden, I saw really world-class acting, like 6 inches away from my face. And I was like, I couldn't even stand the scene. It was like, whoa, you're good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was just, I would love to have the experience of somebody, you know, within a scene. Because I'm always addressing the audience. And it's so interesting to me when you see really, really good actors, how they get into that moment, you know, into that thing.
But so for you, you're committed to do this for a while, the Vegas thing.
Yeah, you know, whenever
that thing might be in the future.
Whenever I can find time, you know, whenever I can find a week or two, I agree. You know, it's like Teller flies back and forth to Chicago to direct The Tempest.
Right.
And I just finished up this movie that I crowdfunded that I act in. It's a movie called Director's Cut, and it's a crazy movie. The idea of the movie, I was really fascinated by the idea that information is out there. Information is out there. So now when you make a movie, it all gets put into hard drives and it's on sharers and people can get it. So I postulated a guy who was obsessed with an actress, obsessed with her, and the movie was being crowdfunded and crowdfunded his way onto the set and then got the codes to get all the outtakes from the movie and then kidnaps her and then uses all the footage to make his own movie that tells his own story with him as the star. So we had Missy Pyle, who's...
So it was like the sequel to Human Centipede.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Except, not as sick as that.
But, well, not as sexually but sick, but intellectually sick.
But I love
sick.
The meta of the sequel.
Oh, it's very, very meta.
Yeah.
And I play Herbert, who's the guy who does this and who's on the set. And then I get to have the scenes where the two men who are acting in it are doing a scene with her, but she's in my basement. So I've tried to match the scene to match that. So it's all about continuity and changing that and all about movie making.
You and I should do a horror movie.
Oh, yes.
Like a really low rent horror movie.
Yes.
Something really tawdry and disgusting. And
yeah, well, we,
but with a conscience.
Anything, anything.
With a conscience.
Yes, of course. We have to have anything, conscience. Anything I could do to. I
would, a couple of atheists.
Sure. No, Catholic and an atheist.
a Catholic and an atheist meet. We're hobos. Sure. We're jugglers. And we're juggling by fire.
And we'll get someone to do your arms so you can have some.
CGI it.
Even the fact that you're doing this.
All I got to do like this.
Yeah.
It tells you.
Well,
you got to go like this.
Or, I'll work with you a little bit on how you move your arms. It's not.
That's something else.
We'll do it.
That's a urologist.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, tell me, what is movie night? You're a movie fan. What's movie night?
Tuesday nights after my show, people come over. And we watch a
movie. In Vegas,
over my house.
They have a killer screening room.
Yeah, and we have about sometimes 20, 30 people come over.
You love movies.
And, well, yes, but this is not showing the love of movies. This is just 30 people screaming.
Right.
And people think when they come over that it's going to be witty. It's not witty.
Yeah.
Simply obscenity. Right. It's simply spewing out the bile from the week.
You do.
It's a group encounter session.
So you mock the movie.
Much more than Mark.
More than Mark.
And now we're in the middle of 24. We're watching every season of 24.
Oh, fantastic.
And I am so trying to convince Kiefer to come by one night. Because I would love to have him screaming. Yes.
Screaming. Easier to scream at Kiefer.
How tall are you exactly, Kiefer? You know, and it's just screaming. It's just getting, because, you know, I tend to, because I have, my children are 9 and 10 years old, and because I do so many shows and have so much stuff going on, I really don't get a chance to hang out with friends. So this is my 2 hours a week.
Yeah.
That just, it's what
your poker game.
What some, yeah, exactly. It's what some guys would do with poker.
Yeah.
It's just yelling.
So when did you become this arbiter of bullshit? When did it just the things that you strike you as bullshit, that's whatever word you want to use, disingenuous or false or whatever, it sat in your craw. How long before you decided, I got to do a TV show out of this?
We have always wanted to do a skeptical TV show. Always. And we started pitching that in the 80s.
Teller, too.
Yeah. And we're both, you know, there's two very strong schools in magic. There's the Houdini school, which is the, as Robert Houdin said, we are actors playing the parts of magicians. It also starts with in the 16th century, the discovery of witchcraft, which is the first book written that says this stuff is fake. We are doing tricks. There's that whole school that believes that the magician is someone who helps us study how we ascertain truth. In other words, I've studied trickery, so let's talk about the truth. Then there's a whole other school, which is, you know, David Blaine, for instance, who's a friend of mine and who we get along with well. We have a very strong philosophical disagreement. He believes that the magician's job is to distort reality, that you must leave his show thinking things that aren't true.
Uh-huh.
He believes that strongly and can make a very cogent argument for it, which I disagree with. But I know, I like him. There's those two schools. And Tell and I have always been strongly in the Houdini, Amazing Randy camp on that.
And, P.S., I don't see a David Blaine theater in Vegas, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't know who I'm putting my money on. Although we had him on the show and he was great.
He's great. He's wonderful. He's a great, great magician and a great guy. So we've been pushing this. And I would go in and say, the nuts always have the passion. And the scientists always have this low-key, measured way. What we will give you in bullshit is we will do the best to give you the scientific point of view done with the passion of a nut. And I'm willing to give you all that passion and rip my heart open and be wrong and go off half-cocked. But I'm going to do it for the other side.
And the topics came to you. Like, what was the first show?
Well, the first show is very complex because the first show was about talking to the dead. And we conceived the show to attack, you know, John Edward and those people who say they can communicate with the dead.
Sure.
And I conceived it intellectually. And then while thinking about it, my mom died at the age of 90 in 2000. And we started doing the show in 2001. And this happened, forgive me for, I'm only in this one way comparing myself to Houdini. But Houdini had this intellectual dislike for people who claimed to talk to the dead. And it was a lot of Houdini's posturing. I do better tricks than them. I do tricks no one can figure out. Their tricks aren't that good. And then his mom dies. And Arthur Conan Doyle, Sherlock Holmes writer, who was a big believer in spiritualist. Mm-hmm. Houdini wanted to be around him because Houdini was the son of a rabbi, but was not well educated. And Arthur Conan Doyle was very respected and very well educated. And Houdini was thrilled to be traveling in that circle. He was cheap carny trash traveling the circle with the intellectuals. He loved
it. Eric Weiss.
Yeah. And his mother, Houdini's mother died, and Arthur Conan Doyle's wife did automatic writing, okay, which was you would just write, and it was the spirits talking through you. And Arthur Conan Doyle said, well, you know, you miss your mom so much, because Houdini was another similarity, a mama's boy, which I was. I was very close to my mom. And Houdini, you know, okay, this is a little dangerous. You're going to talk to my mom, but okay. So his wife sat down and then did automatic writing. And
Conan Doyle's wife.
Yeah. Ooh, and at the top of the page.
What I would have given to be there.
Was a cross. And the first words were, "Dear Harry." And then it went on. Now, what Arthur Conan Doyle's wife didn't know was that his mother didn't speak English. He was born in Budapest. He claimed to be from Appleton, Wisconsin. He was actually born in Budapest. He was the son of a rabbi. Cross at the top, probably not right. And his mother never once called him Harry. That was his stage name. So Houdini felt what it feels like to have your image of someone you love distorted. And Houdini went apeshit. And then the second half of his career was all busting these people.
Debunking.
And so we were going to do Talking to the Dead. And we did that show, you know, within a year of my mom dying. And so it was very, very passionate. Because the point that people don't make is a lot of times the people that do this communication with the dead, they say that they're bringing solace to people. The most valuable thing I have in my life is the memories of my family. My mom and dad, also, you know, my children, the new memories I'm making, but let's go with from the past, the memories of my mom and dad. If I come to you grief-stricken about my mom and you claim that you're communicating with her and then we have some sort of communication, what you have done, you can call it bringing solace, but you can also see it as distorting my memory. You've now said something that she never said.
Right.
And right. I cannot think of a crueler thing. In order to get power and make money, you're doing this. And it's actually the most valuable thing.
It's like lying
about
me while I'm alive.
Yeah.
Yeah, same thing.
And it's horrible. I am naturally not cynical. And when you're naturally not cynical, you bump into this stuff all the time.
Sure.
I tend to be skeptical but not cynical. And people always put those together. And they are very different emotional states. You know, skepticism is cold and cynicism is hot. You know, cynicism is everybody's full of shit, everybody's lying to us, everybody's doing this. Skepticism is let's get to the truth. And those are two very different things. You know, when I talked to Bill Maher about this, because Bill Maher is proudly cynical and I am proudly skeptical, and we are different things. Mm-hmm. And it's a very different reaction.
Well put.
And I think that if you get too Pollyanna, and I am very Pollyanna, I am much too optimistic. I'm much too straightforward. It's one of the things
that
you
mom
get.
Of yours.
You get with a perfect. You know, everybody in show business complains. I'm from a dysfunctional family. I drop out of those conversations. You know, my dad never got the memo that dads are supposed to give you conditional love. Right. He never got that. He was just unconditional love and supportive, and even things he didn't understand. My parents tried from the time I was 17 until the day they died. Tried to get me to cut my hair. And the really funny part of it was, and this, boy, this made me laugh, is my mother, when she was in her 80s, and I was in my 40s, my mother actually said, I just love this moment, my mom's sitting there and she goes, you know, Penn, when you were a young man, having the long hair was fine.
Yeah.
But now that you're older, I mean, you're older than middle-aged, and you have some gray in there, you need to get your hair cut. And I said, Mom, this is how far we've come. We've now come to the point where now it was okay when I was young. That never happened. Because right. Every single time she saw me, that battle went on. But I want to say, and I want to say this proudly to the world, that before my mother died, I went out one evening when visiting her, and remembered to get milk on the way home. Something I had never done my entire life before.
I know, as we sign off here, Marietta, I know what play you and I should do.
What's that?
We're going to do a play together.
Okay.
We're going to do Beckett.
Oh, I would, nothing I would like
we'll
more.
We'll do Beckett together.
Nothing
on
I would
Broadway.
Like. Nothing, sure.
I mean, we may bomb. We may bomb.
Yeah. Oh,
we,
yeah, but
we
may.
We'll do it for us.
Oh, I would
remember,
give anything.
We only do it for us.
I would do it for, I would do, give anything. Can we set that up, Glenn? Look, Glenn says yes.
If you missed Penn and Teller during their six-week run on Broadway this summer, you can catch them in Vegas. I'm Alec Baldwin, and this is Here's the Thing. Here's the Thing is produced by WNYC Radio in association with Stony Brook Southampton Graduate Arts.